Jacob Friedenberg. We have media news from the European Union.
What is the European Media Freedom Act?
Can the European Union's new legislation keep media independent? Will it influence media ownership and influence further transparency? Is this about editorial freedom from government control? Do all member states of the EU agree with these new rules?
From the United Arab Emirates, can the UAE control what Amazon sells in the UAE?
Why is the UAE forcing Amazon to take down LGBTQ plus content from the Amazon marketplace? Why is Amazon following the UAE's instructions to hide these items from Emirati shoppers?
We have news from Romania.
The Romanian government is proposing anti-LGBTQ education legislation. We have some familiar with that in America here with Florida going on recently, but do Romanian school children need this protection, or is this homophobia? Is this proposed law the first step towards censoring all LGBTQ content from the Romanian media?
From Afghanistan, what's left of media freedom with the Taliban in power?
How are journalists doing under Taliban rule? Are there any independent journalists? Is there a free press in Kabul? Can reporters still report, or has the state captured the news media?
From Japan, are the news media biased against the Unification Church? Why is Unification Church in the news in Japan?
Followers of the Unification Church in Japan allege that the news media is biased against their church. Are the Japanese news media unfair to the followers of the Reverend Moon?
From China, we have an update on the protests and social media in China.
Has the government been able to prevent protesters from using social media to dissent? Will the protesters go home now that the government is lifting the lockdown and COVID restrictions amid the white paper protests? How important was social media in these protests?
Social media? Elon Musk has broken all the rules on Twitter. Can Twitter still do business in Asia without a rulebook to control content?
Shocker, shocker. Elon Musk did exactly what he'd say. He has opened up the floodgates at Twitter. Will his libertarian approach to content moderation work under the strict content regulations for social media in Asia? Will Elon Musk start following the rules if Twitter is threatened with penalties for not complying with Asian nation laws?
All this and more coming up on OWWR, Old Westbury Web Radio, streaming live from the State University of New York College at Old Westbury.
Let's talk about European media. The European Union is concerned about media independence and diversity. Is there a lack of transparency about media ownership and influence? Are the news media under pressure from governments in Europe? The EU lawmakers in Brussels have an answer. It is called the European Media Freedom Act, or EMFA. We have brought in Jessica Farrell to tell us about what this is. So, Jessica, what is the EMFA?
The European Media Freedom Act is intended to protect media pluralism and independence in the EU. Two major factors of this EMFA are editorial independence and clear media ownership. The International Press Institute says that the EMFA will protect journalists and their independence.
Why is the European Media Freedom Act needed?
One reason the EMFA is needed is for there to be editorial independence. Part of this will allow editors to be able to refuse to sign articles or anything that has been changed without their knowledge or against their will. A second reason for this is for there to be transparency of media ownership. Media ownership is important for people to know the interests of the media source.
Who is in favor of the European Media Freedom Act?
European Union lawmakers are in favor of the EMFA. According to Alliance of Liberals and Democrats for Europe Party, says it will help people regain trust in media and help limit the amount of disinformation there is out there. For New Media B, I'm Jessica Farrell. Back to you, Jacob.
Thanks, Jessica. Now, let's talk about shopping. I don't know about y'all, but I love shopping. I love Amazon, love Target. I bet we spend a lot of money at these stores. But do shoppers all over the world see the same products on Amazon as we see here? Or are there regional and national differences? How are these decisions made? Is it a platform decision made by global giants like Amazon? Should the government be able to control what their citizens see when they go shopping online? The United Arab Emirates, or the UAE, is a tiny, oil-rich nation on the Arabian Peninsula with a lot of buying power. Online shopping is popular in the UAE, and Amazon is ready to deliver whatever Emirati shoppers want to put in their shopping carts. But the Emirati government has had other ideas about the freedom to shop online. The UAE is trying to control which items Emirati shoppers get to see on Amazon. Does Amazon have to follow these rules? Tanya Fizeme has this story for us here at New Media B. So, Tanya, Why is the UAE unhappy with some of the items on Amazon?
So the UAE is unhappy because they are selling LGBTQ products on their website and homosexuality is deemed illegal.
What has the UAE prohibited Amazon from doing?
So the UAE has threatened Amazon in hiding over about 150 keywords from their website, anything related to pride.
What are the consequences against the LGBTQ community?
Because homosexuality is deemed illegal in the UAE, their usual outcomes result with a fine and or imprisonment. The most severe punishment is the death penalty. Transgenders and cross-dressing are also considered as a public offense. This offense can result in up to 1 year of imprisonment and between 1,000 AED, which is around $300 in the U.S. currency, to 50,000 AED, which is around $13,000.
Wow, sounds like harsh penalties. So do you think from Amazon's standpoint, did this come down to business or what's ethically correct?
Although Amazon has vouched for the LGBTQ community, sharing their support, I do think complying to the UAE government shows they were focusing on the money. Last reported in 2021, Amazon generated about $520 million from UAE customers, being the number one ranked store in the UAE. So with that much traction, it's expected to follow where the money goes.
Has there been previous history with Amazon against LGBTQ rights?
Yes, around February 2021. Seattle Pride had changed their mind with partnering up with Amazon for their Seattle Pride parade due to Amazon donating over about $460,000 to politicians. They had voted against the Equality Act, which inhibits discrimination towards an individual's sex or orientation. For New Media Beat, I'm Tanya Fiesemann. Back to you, Jacob.
Thank you, Tanya. The UAE is not the only government that has had problems with LGBTQ culture. Adiashvili has reported about Romania. A new law is being debated to ban LGBTQ content from schools. Ani, what is this new education law and how could it affect the media in Romania?
Lawmakers are pushing for a new anti-LGBTQ bill that would ban any discussion of homosexuality or gender identity in all public and private spaces, including schools, workplaces, and the internet and other mass medias. This will become an issue in media because they will use it as a scapegoat to censor LGBTQ people online. They will use pedophilia as the scapegoat because in Romania, LGBTQ people are associated with pedophilia. Homosexuality tends to be associated with it, so this will further isolate their community and people who already face oppression and isolation from the rest of society. This kind of censorship affects their community, of course, as other journalists, people in the advertising industry, medics, mental health experts, LGBT people are everywhere.
What are the attitudes towards the LGBTQ community in Romania?
They're a stigmatized minority group, and homosexuality remains an emotional, social, and political issue in Romania. Romanians, post-communist society remains deeply patriarchal, traditional, and conservative. Most people in Romania agree that homosexuality is a sin and commonly describe LGBT people as the ultimate enemy or Satan's army. The public position of the church has been overwhelmingly homophobic, and LGBT people are not celebrated or accepted. They deal with discrimination in healthcare, workplace, and education. They experience unequal treatment and harassment, especially within the health system. According to the Danish Institution of Human Rights, 58% experience discrimination, such as name-calling, in the healthcare system, and 28% have been threatened with physical violence. The threat of physical violence is a very common type of discrimination, especially in the health system, but everywhere in Romania for LGBT people. Also, there are normality marches that happen, which are anti-LGBT marches. Pride marches also have been responded to with violent responses such as religious icons, crosses transformed into weapons, eggs, attacks and smoke bombs and rocks thrown at participants.
How does this attitude towards the LGBTQ community reflect in the media in Romania?
The collective hate towards LGBT people in Romania definitely reflects in their media. They're not only underrepresented, but they're bashed and degraded. LGBT people are portrayed in exaggerated stereotypes. They're commonly described as indecent, provocative, promiscuous, and inappropriate. As I mentioned, in Romania, especially in the media, they generally represent LGBT people as pedophiles and a threat to children. They commonly are referred to as perverts and merry boys. Such stereotyping is not only due to a lack of information from journalists, but also an absence of a coming out culture due to the stigma and discrimination that follows coming out. There is limited perspective, education, or even conversation on this subject, which results in personal under-research and biased comments all throughout the media. Topics such as gay pride and same-sex marriage frequently reach the news headlines, and some report in a neutral way, but most show negative attitudes and engage in derogatory jokes.
And lastly, is there a free media in Romania?
They have declining media freedom in Romania as of right now. The television market, for example, is divided up by two companies, the Central European Media Enterprises, which runs ProTV, which is the most successful television channel in Romania, and the Intact Media Group, which runs another highly popular channel, Antena One, among other media outlets. There's no range in the media in Romania, which is an issue. The recent takeover from CME from its American owners by the Czech financial group, PPF, run by Peter Kellner, an oligarch, definitely does not help independent journalism. Romanian government is not in favor of independent journalism, which is also an issue, because journalistic investigations, unlike opinion counterparts, can better contribute to the role of social change that the media needs. There's a lack of unbiased and homophobic media content, which obviously contributes significantly to anti-gay attitudes. The only space where journalism can really thrive in Romania is in the internet. However, many of the independent journalist companies are small and struggling financially, and this new law puts it at risk because now they might not even have a space to discuss any of these topics, and since the internet is truly the only space left for the LGBT community to find a safe space to express themselves and share the discrimination and violence they face today, day to day, would be put at risk with this new law. For New Media B, I am Ani Ashvili. Back to you, Jacob.
Thank you, Ani. The Taliban have been running Afghanistan since August of 2021. Is there still a free press in Afghanistan? Are reporters able to work without the fear of surveillance or retaliation? Has the Taliban state captured the Afghan press?
The news about press freedom in Afghanistan is grim. The Taliban do not believe in a free press. Media freedom has been curtailed. Is there any independent news media left in Afghanistan? What is the role of the Taliban state? Here with an update on a journalist in Afghanistan is my co-host, Jacob Friedenberg. Jacob, it has been more than a year since the Taliban took power again in Kabul. What has changed for media and Afghan journalists since August of 2021?
So yeah, unless you've been living under a rock, the Taliban did take over Afghanistan in August of 2021. Since then, journalists and women primarily have faced large-scale criticism and fears of censorship in a post-U.S. Afghanistan. A patriarchal society has been rebuilt from the ground up, and it's been problematic for many different groups of people.
When did the situation in Afghanistan start?
So again, unless you haven't been reading the news, which I'm not saying to you personally, but in case you haven't been reading the news, Afghanistan has been taken over by the Taliban. This started back in 2020 when President Trump decided to make a deal with the Taliban that said will give you certain incentives if you guys stay out of the Afghanistan region. And then with the transfer of power, President Biden made it one of his campaign goals to pull out of Afghanistan completely. Before the pull out of Afghanistan, we had gone 18 months without a death of any of our U.S. troops. And then in August of 2021, he pulls out all the troops, and unfortunately, 13 U.S. servicemen get killed. And ultimately, what's really wild is that the Taliban actually offered President Biden the opportunity to pull everybody out before they took over, and President Biden said no. Nonetheless, after the U.S. pulled out, that is when the Taliban started to censor opposition and the groups whom they saw as other.
Who's been affected since the Taliban decided to take over?
The primary groups that have been affected since the Taliban's takeover are journalists and women. Women have been forced to wear head coverings. They can't leave the house beyond a certain distance without being chaperoned by a male relative. And they've even been stopped from being allowed to attend school, according to Al Jazeera. Journalists have been forced to write about the Taliban narrative and copy whatever the regime wants said. Women journalists especially, while there are now far and few between, there used to be like 500 plus women journalists in Afghanistan. Now, they're probably in the dozens, if that. And whenever they're on air, they have to wear head coverings as well. And the real thing that these reporters risk being there is that they risk beatings, expulsion from the country, and death, according to Sharif Hassan of the New York Times in 2021.
What types of censorship has been occurring in Afghanistan?
There's been at least 245 cases of censorship, detention, and violence against media personnel that have been reported, according to the Afghanistan Journalist Center. Two major news websites in Afghanistan, the Zawiya Media and Hasht-e-Sub, have been shut down by the Taliban, according to Reporters Without Borders. Reporters Without Borders also discussed that since 2021, the country has lost 219 of the 547 outlets it had before the Taliban takeover. Another stat that the country has lost 60% of its journalists since the fall. Recently, two journalists in Kabul were arrested for covering the protests that were going on, according to the New York Times. And according to the International Federation of Journalists, in March of this year, three Tolo News employees were arrested. These employees, according to Yahoo Finance, were arrested over the airing of a story about the censorship of a foreign drama in Kabul.
It sounds like a nightmare over there. How does the Taliban respond to these claims?
Funny enough, according to VOA News, the Taliban have been claiming that they are going through what is called a media reform. I know that you're buying as much as I am, but they are bragging that their reform is stopping content which they deem to be indecent. And basically, if you are understanding this, they basically mean any foreign media that has females in a lead role in it, or those who either oppose Islam or the Taliban. They are banning any sort of content which they deem to be in that sphere of either being pro-woman or being anti-Islam or anti-Taliban.
What's the outlook for Afghanistan going forward?
So some are hopeful of what could happen to the country. Ayaz Ghul in VOA News wrote an article discussing how the global governments are slowly starting to run out of patience with the Taliban and are refusing to legitimize it, which is also Bilal Swari is just one journalist who called out the regime's oppressive rule. The Afghan journalist went as far in an interview with Democracy Now! To say that the Taliban must allow a free and thriving press. But from a larger point of view, it's quite bleak. An Afghan journalist, Nasreen Shirzad, who fled to Pakistan, says the West has abandoned them and no one is trying to protect them, according to Gandhara News. Ultimately, the individuals responsible for this regime coming into power need to face consequences. And yes, with all due respect to the office of the president, President Biden needs to be asked the ultimate question. Why did we pull out of Afghanistan despite the threats of the Taliban and despite these very foreseeable consequences? The House of Representatives should be having committees about this. The Senate should be having hearings to discover how we got here. Because, again, this was all avoidable. The Taliban did not move in until President Biden told everyone publicly multiple times during press conferences that under no circumstances were they staying in Afghanistan, even though the very deal that was struck with President Trump, while President Trump is not necessarily a positive, the deal that was struck with the Taliban was conditional, and he made it sound like he had no choice but to pull out. Countries should be going in and attempting to overthrow this regime, because ultimately, how are we able to say that this is all an internal issue when human rights are being oppressed, when women and journalists are not only being really hurt and oppressed, but some of them are even being killed for their dissent. Especially because if the warnings from our intelligence agencies like the CIA are true, there are terrorist groups like ISIS-K who are responsible for the death of those 13 American service members I mentioned before during the pullout. They are sitting in Afghanistan now waiting to make their move in other areas of the region. And they're only going to grow in their capacity to attack and do harm. They will stop at nothing less but the total destruction of the West, the destruction of certain ethnic groups, and anyone who does not want to bow the knee to their regime. We need to be extremely careful of the next steps we take. And ultimately, the situation shouldn't have happened. And it frustrates me that this is not talked about more because, generally speaking, the group of people, the Islam community is a great community, and you just have this handful of people that are destroying their reputation here in America because they want to build a patriarchal society that only benefits them. And how is it that America can claim to be the defender of human rights but not go and defend human rights and surrender to the predations of the Taliban? There needs to be accountability, ultimately. For New Media Beat, I'm Jacob Greenberg. Back to you, Ananda.
Thanks, Jacob. Alex Heiko is on the Japanese Media Beat for us. This week, Alex has a report about the recent allegations of bias in the Japanese news media. The charges of bias are coming from the followers of the Unification Church, who claim that the news media do not treat their church fairly. What do we need to know about the Unification Church to understand these allegations of media bias? Why is the Unification Church controversial in Japan? Alex, why was the Unification Church in the news recently, media in Japan?
So the Unification Church has been in the news because it's come together to protest in Seoul, to protest the unfair media coverage of the church. There's many people out in Seoul that are protesting and saying stop bias reporting and religious persecution.
So who was Shinzo Abe?
So he was the former prime minister who was assassinated in early July, killed by a man who held a grudge against the Unification Church. His grudge was he believed that had ties over his mother's bankruptcy, which was in 2002. The gunman had said that his mother made very big donations to the church, and those donations ended up ruining his family. The church begs to differ, so they don't agree, and the Japanese have mourned death every day that goes by.
Why is the church protesting?
The church is protesting because there are followers of the church that are being kidnapped or confined by their own relatives. And the relatives, they're doing this because they want to attempt to deprogram them from their current religion. An example of this is Toro Goto was confined in a Tokyo apartment for over 12 years, and his family members tried to force him into renouncing his faith. Another thing that they're saying at these protests is stop the assault on human rights and never forgive the business of kidnapping and confinement. For New Media Beat, I'm Alex Heiko. Back to you, Ananda.
Thank you, Alex. Is the COVID lockdown in China ending? Did protesters force the government to lift the lockdown restriction? What part did social media play in these protests?
Let's get an update about the recent protests going on in China amid the COVID lockdown restrictions. The people in China have been locked down amid fears of a COVID outbreak and China's zero COVID policy. Amanda Hogarth-Shannon has been following the media news from China. Social media was an important part of the anti-lockdown protests that broke out in China. It seems that the government is backing down amid the white paper protests. Ananda, have the protesters won? What has the role of the media been in these protests? And has the government been able to censor social media protests?
In actuality, the protesters did win. They were protesting the zero COVID policy. Protests started because during one of the zero COVID lockdowns, a fire broke out and 10 people died. The protesters blame the zero COVID policy for it because it did not allow the people who unfortunately passed to escape, nor did it allow for efficient first responder to come and help and save them.
Yeah, that's such a tragedy that people had to die because of this policy, although for me, at least, the worst part of that policy would be having to get that test shoved up my nose every day. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. Why are these people protesting?
They were protesting the zero COVID policy, but furthermore, they were just really protesting for their freedom. It's been 3 years since the first COVID outbreak, and since then, China has only continued to crack down. And following the deaths of people in this fire, they had enough. And they were demanding their freedom. Some even were reported by the BBC chanting for the president to step down, which is something we haven't heard since the Tiananmen Square massacre back in the 1980s.
It's not a good correlation that you want to have. What is the government doing in response to these protests and the outright opposition to their policy?
The government has been obviously sending out police to arrest protesters in droves. However, they took a new approach this time in using facial recognition software off of cell phone cameras. So they tap into the cell phone cameras, and then they can track who it is and get all the information, date of birth, address, next of kin, go to their address and arrest them. And since the news got out, people online were telling protesters, find some way to not allow yourself to be tracked and leave your phone at home, because that's how one protester got arrested, which is why you're seeing pictures of protesters holding white paper. The white paper does not allow for you to be seen during the protests and allows protesters to remain anonymous, so that way they can protect their safety.
It's one genius way to protest using white paper. I just love the idea. It's fantastic. And that makes sense what you said before about, you know, how they connect different people to their identities by using IP addresses on their individual devices through social media and all that means. And speaking of social media, what role has social media played thus far in this situation?
Social media has played a large role in this situation. Social media allowed protesters to stay connected to one another. So if there were any updates about arrests, social media is also how they found out that they were using facial recognition software to arrest people. And it's also been able to hold the government accountable for the arrest. A BBC reporter was even arrested for covering the protests back in November on the 28th. Social media made that post go viral because it is a BBC reporter that was clearly based in Britain. You're not supposed to arrest foreign journalists, but they did that. With the post going viral, the government was like, okay, we'll let this reporter go, because people were calling for the release of this journalist, Edward Lawrence, and they were also demonstrating the brutality that the police were using against protesters when they were arrested. If they showed that same level of brutality to Edward, you can only imagine what they were doing when it was off camera.
Seems like a very grim situation going on in China, but I mean, clearly they're getting their news out some way. I mean, we've heard about the length of the protests. We know about the situation with the 10 people dying in the fire over there. So my last question is, even though the message is spreading via social media, what's preventing it from spreading even further to the point where this becomes such a mainstream issue that you can't talk to anybody on the street without them knowing what this is?
Chinese censorship. That's pretty much the long and short of it. It's a marvel that we know as much as we do about what's been going on regarding the protests, but we don't know more because of Chinese censorship. Anytime there has been a mass influx of social media posts about it, they've been just as quickly taken down. Also, China doesn't have the same social media apps that we do, so it's more heavily monitored. So that's why we don't know more. If it was a different situation, then, yeah, we could have seen more coverage about it from mainstream media here at home, but we haven't because, well, we only get as much as the Chinese government allows us to. For a new Media Beat, I'm Ananda Holger-Shin, and back to you, Jacob.
Thank you, Ananda. You have to be careful. We don't want the Chinese government censoring this, but Twitter has an eccentric new owner. His name, if you haven't figured it out yet, is Elon Musk, you know, the owner of Tesla. And he's breaking all the rules of normal social media ownership and management. He's been calling shots on who gets censored and who's not. He has been ultimately changing Twitter policy in the sense of more free speech rather than censorship. But Twitter is a global business. It has users all over the world. Will it keep those users after the recent dramatic changes at Twitter? How will Elon Musk's disruption of Twitter affect its business in Asia, broadly speaking? Asia is an important market for the major global social media platforms. But Asian nations have rules. Media is regulated. If Twitter stops moderating content and allows complete freedom of expression, will Twitter still be able to access Asian markets where there are often strict rules about social media content? Who's going to regulate it if Elon Musk won't? Luca Giannalise has done the research. Luca, why should Elon's Twitter be nervous about the social media rules in Asia?
The rules and regulations that happen within Asia when it comes to social medias, especially Twitter, they're really harsh. And we've seen that Elon Musk, as soon as he bought Twitter, he wanted to put in new policies that would really lessen the censorship. So that's going to go against a lot of these Asian laws.
What are the specific problems that Elon's going to be facing when it comes to Twitter in Asia?
Well, to start with, Asia, which has the world more than half of the world's population, is a huge market for Twitter. Right. So the policies that Elon Musk wants to implement, again, is less censorship. And this reason why is because he wants more diverse conversations to happen on this app. But the reality is in Asia that especially the three main countries that we're looking at is India, Vietnam, and Thailand. They won't be allowing these policies to go through that freely because they have anti-propaganda laws that really censorship and grip the power of what people can say on Twitter and all these social media apps.
So you mentioned that certain countries have specific rules, as we just covered. China has been censoring a lot of content besides China. Are there any countries where this freedom to say anything will be an issue? I know you had just mentioned, you know, Vietnam, India, and I believe it was Thailand. Are there any other countries where this freedom to express yourself is going to be an issue?
Yeah, well, it's mainly those three countries, but the biggest one here is India, because out of the whole Twitter usage, there's 38.6 million Twitter users, which is Twitter's fourth largest market. So that's going to be a really big issue when Elon goes in there and says, you know, these are my policies, but India will fight back. So it's India, Vietnam, and Thailand. And again, even in Vietnam, we saw laws being put into place by the government control over social media and what is being said.
What has the response been to the situation in Asia with Twitter?
Well, there's been major responses within the company and outside. A lot of people are saying that there will be a worse relationship between Asia and Twitter. But it's not only going to affect Twitter itself. Elon, as we know, is also the owner of SpaceX and Tesla. For New Media Beat, I'm Luca Giannalise. Back to you, Jacob.
Thanks, Luca.
Thank you for listening to New Media Beat. Thanks to our producer, Michael Green, and our engineer, Tanya Fizeme. Thank you to my co-host, Jacob Friedenberg.
Thanks, Ananda. Today we heard reports from Jessica Farrow, Tanya Fizeme, our engineer, Jacob Friedenberg, myself, Alex Heiko, Ananda Hogarth-Shannon, my co-host, Ani Ashvili, and Luca Giannalise.
New Media Beat is brought to you by OWWR, Old Westbury Rep Radio, and the Media and Communications Department here at the State University of New York, College at Old Westbury.
For more media news and resources, check out our latest posts at newmediabeat.org. That is newmediabeat.org, where you can listen to all of our webcasts and even subscribe to our podcast feed.
Follow us on Twitter at OWWRGMN. That is at OWWRGMN.